It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, where you live in Wisconsin can have a big impact on your overall health. A population researcher tells us why health outcomes can vary so much between counties.
Now in its first official action since the emergence of a photo showing male high school students giving what appears to be a Nazi salute, the Baraboo School Board has approved an anti-hate resolution.
It's called Baraboo United Against Hate. It commits to providing an inclusive learning environment without regard to a student's sex, race, religion, national origin, ancestry, color, creed, and more. One school board member reportedly said the proclamation is just the beginning.
The photo, featuring about 60 boys, was taken last spring outside the Sauk County Courthouse. The photographer says the boys were following his instruction to wave goodbye to their parents before heading to prom. The photo went viral this month after a reporter in New York tweeted it.
Last week, school officials decided not to punish any of the students because they said it's impossible to know their intent. They added that the students' speech is protected by the First Amendment.
Jeff Spitzer-Resnick is a civil rights lawyer in Madison who specializes in education law and school discipline. He's also the president of the Sharei Shamayim Synagogue in Madison, and he wrote an open letter to the Baraboo School District. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
A lot here to get into. Let's start with this idea of the school district saying we can't punish the kids. Even if we wanted to, there would be First Amendment concerns there. What's your read on that?
Well, I have two reactions. First of all, I want to be clear. I have never advocated punishing these children. I think the issue is around education or lack thereof leading up to this incident, and now the need to educate further, and I'm glad to see the Baraboo School District appears to at least be starting that process. My concern around throwing up a so-called First Amendment shield around this Nazi salute is I think it sends the wrong message and is actually counter to the intention of educating not only these students, but the rest of the public. What is the message being sent when the first statement that the district says around so-called discipline is the First Amendment protects his speech? First of all, as you said in your lead up, if this is just a wave, then there's no need to even be discussing the First Amendment. So it lends a lot more credence to the fact that it wasn't just a wave. Second of all, as I wrote in a follow-up op-ed around First Amendment, what I called hypocrisy, there are school districts all around the state, and it's been in the news, that routinely punish, for example, kids of color who flash gang signs. And how is this any different? While I generally defend children from being punished for, frankly, all kinds of activity, the issue is, what's the message the school district is sending? And by saying the First Amendment protects you, it's, I think, sending the wrong message.
A big part, as you said, of your open letter wasn't so much about whether or not students should be disciplined, but what kind of conversations and education should be going on now and maybe should have been going on previous to this incident. What kind of things would you like to see in our schools when it comes to talking about Nazi symbolism, Holocaust history, and more?
Well, I think there are a number of things, and you've touched on a couple. First is certainly, of course, Holocaust education and Nazi symbolism, but it's important to put this in the context of a larger and very unfortunate movement in our country that's been emerging, particularly since the 2016 election, where safe space has been given by our president and many other politicians to white nationalism. And this Nazi salute is a symbol of white nationalism. So it goes far beyond anti-Semitism. And let's not forget that the Nazis didn't want to just wipe out the Jewish people. They may have been their number one target, but they targeted anyone else who they didn't consider so-called Aryan. But second of all, I think students need to learn what I think is a very important really thinking process known as critical thinking. I suspect that many of those students who engaged in that behavior did not really know what they were doing, some of whom have actually publicly come out saying that they were, either feel bad about it or, in fact, didn't participate in it. How do students learn? How do children learn when to make tough choices? And that's a critical thinking process. Last but not least, I really think that every school district should have a quality restorative justice program where, whether or not it's a crime or not, when I will call it harm has been done, and there's no doubt there's been harm done by this picture, how do you restore the situation for the victims of the harm? And you can define all kinds of different victims, whether it's Jewish students, students of color, students who may be in other oppressed minorities. And there are really well-thought-out programs involved in restorative justice to, you know, help heal.
Talking to Jeff Spitzer Resnick, civil rights lawyer in Madison, talking about the photo of the apparent Nazi salute among students in the Baraboo School District, the district's response, and what he'd like to see happen. And Jeff, you're talking about training and critical thinking and putting these things in context. It seems like it'd be easy for a school district or any organization to kind of check off a box. Okay, we had a seminar, or we had a some kind of get together, an assembly. We talked about these things. Boom, we're done. What's the difference between that kind of checking off a box and something that really is ongoing and effective?
You know, I think that's a really good point that you make it, and it's really a matter of not just training and educating your students. It also means training your staff. Not every staff person has the background in these things to be able to give quality education. In fact, there was a recent article where a guardian of two students in Baraboo was commenting about how her two middle schoolers came home with very different responses from teachers, one of whom was, hey, this picture's not a problem, let's move on, another of whom really engaged the students in why it was a problem. That's right there in the same school district. What message is being sent to the different students when they're getting a different education? So that means there also needs to be accountability and checking up. Now, I don't expect the Baraboo School District, or frankly any school district, is going to fix this problem immediately, but it does mean really immersing the district in, you know, thorough curriculum, and that means training staff, using some of those professional education days that all districts have to really make sure that they're on board with this type of education and that the students are receiving a pretty similar message. And of course, that message may vary depending on their age, and frankly, I think we should be starting really young. Obviously, the message that's given to a kindergartner isn't the same as given to a 12th grader, but, you know, everybody needs to learn these lessons so that they don't get caught up in this kind of situation. Even social media lessons, how do you handle that? We're all learning the hard way that, you know, once these things go out, you don't have control. One student actually talked to me from Baraboo about wanting to put the genie back in the bottle. I bet there's a lot of people in Baraboo who'd like to do that. And I said, guess what? You don't get to put the genie back in the bottle. The question is, how do you learn to handle that genie?
We're at an interesting time right now, I think it's fair to say, but historically we're at a point when the people who survived the World War II era, the last of them are leaving us, Holocaust survivors, veterans of World War II and more. Does it worry you now that we don't have that body of experience from people who saw the worst case scenario firsthand?
Well, that is a concern. However, there are some still left. In fact, you know, we have a member of our synagogue who talks to our school children about the experiences she had being a teen, and her family fled Germany. They ended up being, basically captive in Amsterdam, and she was kind of like a underground runner of messages as a teen. It's an incredible story, and hearing that from someone in the flesh is really important. But of course, as people age, that's 10 years from now probably going to be impossible. I believe there's a program, believe it or not, in the Illinois Holocaust Museum where they have actually taken many, many videos of having Holocaust survivors answer questions and turn it into an interactive hologram where you can actually ask these hologram survivors, believe it or not, questions that they will answer. And they've done so many, and it's such a sophisticated program that almost any question that's on point, they'll be able to answer. Now, of course, it's not live and in the flesh, but it is a brilliant way of keeping that history alive. I would encourage, frankly, all school districts to take a field trip. You don't have to go all the way to Auschwitz or even the Washington Holocaust Memorial to, you know, experience that kind of education. There's also, even in Milwaukee, Milwaukee Center for Holocaust Education will bring speakers to school districts and have them learn about what really happened at the time.
And Jeff, as we wrap up, the incident, the photo that started all of this was in Baraboo. The response we're talking about is in the Baraboo area. This is not a uniquely Baraboo topic. What are you hoping other school districts are doing now, even though they aren't at front and center in this particular incident?
I'm really glad you asked that question. I've actually been contacted by another rural school district that is being proactive. They want to actually engage in the kind of education that I've just been talking about so that they don't have this problem. I think that this situation in Baraboo should be a wake-up moment for every school district, not just in Wisconsin, but everywhere, and particularly in rural areas where they may not be as diverse a population, so they may not be thinking that this is kind of so-called their problem. Well, Baraboo's finding out the hard way that it is their problem. And, you know, we live in a mobile society, both virtually and literally, so people will interact with people of all kinds of race, colors, and creeds. So, you know, everybody needs to know kind of everybody else's history and be sensitive to it.
Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Jeff Spitzer Resnick is a civil rights lawyer in Madison who specializes in education law and school discipline. He's also president of the Shirai Shamayim Synagogue in Madison. We talked with him about the latest developments on the photo of Baraboo High School students giving what appears to be a Nazi salute.
There are a lot of factors that will impact your overall health. Availability of healthy food, how frequently you exercise, and access to health care can influence your well-being for years. And these factors, in large part, can be determined by where you live.
Our next guest recently analyzed statewide data to see how the county you live in could help shape your well-being.
Malia Jones is an assistant scientist and social epidemiologist at UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory. She recently wrote a piece for WisContext called Comparing Wisconsinites' Health in 2018, County by County. Malia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So what do we learn looking at health county by county that we don't get when we look at a state or even larger a region or a country?
I think what's interesting about looking at these data, which come from the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps Project, is the extent to which the place that you live really does affect your health. And we see these big health disparities at the county level from one county to another that really show that there are differences in terms of both the factors that affect health at the county level and also health outcomes.
Healthy health are words that we use a lot in everyday language. I think we all have ideas of what a healthy person looks like, but I'm guessing that research and data has much more specific ideas of what that means. So what kind of factors are you talking about when you talk about healthy or unhealthy?
In this case, what we're talking about, you're right, there are lots of different ways to measure health. In this case, health outcomes are measured primarily using two sort of factors. The first is length of life, and they look in this case at a measure called years of potential life lost. It's a measure of deaths that occur before people have reached their life expectancy. And then the other part of it is quality of life, and in order to measure quality of life, they looked at whether people report being in good health, whether they report being in good mental health, and preventable hospital visits.
And I should say tomorrow at 4:15 or 4 o'clock, 4:15, we will be talking about the dropping life expectancy rates in the United States. So the project looked at a number of factors such as smoking rates, poverty, access to healthcare, and much more. These all impact health in different ways. Why look at those issues in particular and tease them out from each other?
The project is really focused on solutions, like many public health efforts. And what we want, the purpose of teasing them out separate from each other is so we can look for potential ways to intervene and what might be the most effective way to improve health in those places that are not doing well and what's really working well in the places that are doing well in terms of health outcomes. So when we just look at life expectancy, we see these differences, but it's sort of hard to know what's causing them without unpacking some of those factors that affect differences in life expectancy. And so we look at the different factors, including health behaviors, social and economic conditions, and other factors.
Well, and I found it interesting reading through your article and the report that some of these factors are related, at least in part, to personal decisions, which I think are those that we think of first when we think of, you know, whether someone's right, healthy or not. But many are actually really out of the control of people to control or change.
Right. you're exactly right. A lot of the factors that are listed here are individual health behaviors, and that's what we think of first. You know, things like smoking, exercise, diet decisions, but to some extent, even those behavioral choices are outside of a person's control because people are constrained in terms of the choices they can make by their environment. So people who live in areas that have a really poor food environment might not be able to make high-quality food choices. And then in addition, and actually those health behaviors only make up a small part in terms of how these factors we looked at are weighted. What's much more important is the social and economic conditions that people live in. So things like poverty and unemployment, especially child poverty, really do have a even larger influence on health than those individual choices.
Well, and let's focus in on poverty for a moment. So that is an issue, as you said, that's taken into account when it comes to health. What are some of the specific ways that poverty can impact an individual's health and well-being?
Well, so what science tells us is that poverty affects people in many different ways. One of the pathways is through, as I said before, constraining the choices that we can make. People who live in poverty, you know, can't maybe buy fresh fruits and vegetables, or the most expensive, most wholesome food sources. They might also have inconsistent access to food, so they're struggling with food insecurity. They're more likely to live in poor quality housing and be exposed to violence in the neighborhood that they live in. And then in addition, living in poverty is very stressful. And just that chronic experience of stress activates an immune response that can have really long-term damaging effects on a person's health outcomes, even in the absence of all those other, you know, more direct pathways.
I'm guessing that with all these different factors, some are weighted more heavily than
right.
others. How heavily would you say poverty has to be weighted to really show the impact it's having?
So the social and economic factors together are worth, in this model, 40% of the overall score. And those social and economic factors include things like education, unemployment, poverty, and so forth. In this case, though, children living in poverty is one of the most influential factors of any of the things that we see here. So it's weighted at 7.5% of the overall score. And I think the only thing that ranks higher is adult smoking and unemployment, which are both weighted at 10% of the overall score.
We're talking with Malia Jones right now. She's an assistant scientist and social epidemiologist at UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory. And we're looking at research that looks at health disparities county by county in Wisconsin this year. Malia, you just mentioned adult smoking rates. What are we seeing in the rates of smoking, and how much does that vary from county to county?
We do see variation from county to county. Smoking is definitely a normative behavior. So in some places, it's much more normative to smoke than in others. And so when you look at the map, you can see rates of smoking varying across the different counties. And that does have an effect on the overall health outcomes. So we see, for example, high rates of smoking, as well as higher risk factors and a lot of these other factors we've been talking about in Milwaukee and Menominee counties, which are also ranked highest or lowest in terms of health outcomes.
So, Malia, looking at those maps, and those maps are available at wiscontext.org as part of Malia's article, what parts of the state seem to be doing pretty well overall?
The parts of the state that are doing the best tend to be suburbs and exurbs of our major cities. So these are places that people who have the means to be homeowners in a, you know, suburban neighborhood, send their children to local quality schools. They tend to be more affluent, more white, and within an easy commute of a major metro area. So especially the suburbs of Milwaukee we don't have results at below the county level. If we did, we would see that the suburbs of Madison looked about the same.
And you use the term exurb. What is that exactly?
So an exurb is what we think of as something that's it's sort of a small community just outside of a major city, but it's sort of separated from the city by some kind of rural area in between. So it's like a little community of its own, but it's attached by commuting patterns to a major city.
And what about the parts of the state that aren't doing as well? Where do we find those concentrations?
Well, as I mentioned, the two counties with the lowest health rankings and also health factor rankings are Milwaukee County and Menominee County. And these are our two counties that have historically very disempowered populations, high rates of poverty and child poverty, high rates of risky health behaviors such as smoking and alcohol use. And then outside of those two places, we see sort of a broader pattern where our most rural northern counties have the highest risk factors for health outcomes, as well as the poorest health outcomes.
Were there any surprises in the data for 2018?
The data for 2018 show so one of the things that we're seeing nationwide actually is decreasing obesity rates and the decreasing influence of obesity as one of the major predictors of health outcomes. There are some other surprises in there in terms of tobacco use is not going down the way we would like it to be. Alcohol use has also been pretty stable since the Great Recession. And I think the general patterns have been very durable.
And briefly, as we wrap up, how can public health officials use this data to find and address health issues in their county or statewide?
Well, one of the things that I'm really interested in as a person who studies the way social factors affect health is how weighty those social and economic factors really are in terms of overall health outcomes. And the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps Project actually makes several recommendations that are scientifically grounded about how communities can address social and economic conditions locally in order to help improve some of those outcomes. So addressing major health issues like child poverty and unemployment.
Well, Malia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Malia Jones is an assistant scientist and social epidemiologist at UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory. She was with us to talk about how health disparities around the state are showing up for 2018.
Her piece at WisContext is called Comparing Wisconsinites' Health in 2018 County by County. Find that at wisContext.org. General Motors made a big announcement this week that sent shockwaves through the auto industry and Washington. The company will cut more than 14,000 salaried positions and idle 5 of its factories in the U.S. and Canada.
The move is part of a company-wide restructuring plan, and it has angered President Trump. He told reporters this week that he shared his frustrations with GM CEO Mary Barra.
I said, this country's done a lot for General Motors. You better get back in there soon. That's Ohio, and you better get back in there soon. So we have a lot of pressure on them. You have senators, you have a lot of other people, a lot of pressure.
Micheline Maynard is a longtime auto industry reporter and the author of multiple books about the industry. Mickey, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. I'm so glad to be with you.
Can you first talk about the impact of these cuts on the communities in the cities in the Midwest and Canada that they're located in?
Well, it's really kind of a shock. If you think back almost 10 years now to when the Janesville plant closed in Wisconsin, we kind of knew that was coming. I mean, we actually had years when it was expected that that plant would close. There were hardly any rumors at all about Lordstown in Ohio, the General Motors Pulltown plant here in Detroit, or Oshawa in Ontario. Now, Oshawa did not have a product guaranteed after 2019. So a lot of people figured, well, there's going to be negotiations and they'll put something in that factory. And no, lo and behold, they announced plans to close it. And then there's also transmission plants and a couple of others that will close as well. So I think the first reaction is shock. The second reaction is, what can we do about this? And the third reaction is, what is it going to mean for me if I'm someone who works in one of those factories?
Are we going to see a lot of secondary impact? These auto plants themselves close, the particular, like the transmission plant you mentioned, outside suppliers, auto parts manufacturers. Is this going to close some of them down, or are they able to shift manufacturing to the factories that are still going to be in business?
Well, it's said that every assembly plant job then triggers 3 to 4 more jobs in either other parts companies. If there's a coffee shop across the street from the plant, that sort of thing, they call it the spillover effect. So some of these suppliers are single source suppliers. So, if you make the dashboard for the Impala, you're only making the dashboard for the Impala, and that's one of the cars that's going to go away. So some of these suppliers will be hurt, but yes, there are other car companies, and a lot of these suppliers that are still around are pretty nimble, so I'm sure they're going to be pitching work to other places.
Let's get into why and why now. People have pointed at a lot of causes. One biggie, a common theme seems to be these are plants that are making cars that the American public isn't as interested in and maybe aren't being marketed effectively to the American public.
Right. I actually think it's the latter. I think that Detroit companies in particular have made a specific decision over the last couple of years that they will focus their marketing efforts on SUVs, crossover vehicles, which are car-based sport utilities, and pickup trucks. And it's easy to see why. That's where the profits are. We have reasonable gas prices. So when gas is below $3 a gallon, it's much easier to sell these big vehicles. And the other thing about cars is they're more expensive to produce than pickups and SUVs. And so you might have a car selling for, say, $24,000, but the profit margin is $2,000. You have a pickup truck selling for $24,000, and they're making $6,000 to $8,000 on it. So you can kind of see why they would put the marketing focus on the bigger vehicles.
I want to stay on this point because a story I keep hearing from some people in the industry and elsewhere, the story is we Americans, we want the big cars, we want the cargo space, whatever. That's not the whole story, though, it sounds like you're saying.
No, the interesting thing is the Japanese automakers started building cars in the United States in the 1980s and then really ramped up production in the 90s and the zeros. And essentially, Detroit has kind of waved the white flag in terms of car sales, not obviously SUV and pickup sales, but in terms of automobile sales. They're basically saying, you know what, we're just going to give that piece of the market over to the import companies, which are making these vehicles in the U.S. and Canada, and we're going to focus on the places that we think we can make money.
We're talking about GM plant closures and layoffs with longtime auto industry reporter Micheline Maynard. And Micheline, let's get into now another part of the demand story the future of the industry, the idea that, okay, the future is electric cars, autonomous cars. One theory, one idea I've seen is that GM is saying we need to cut costs now, save some money to help fund this innovative future. Is that part of the story?
Well, it's a piece of the story. So I think the Detroit car makers were very surprised when Tesla came along. Tesla obviously only makes electric cars. And at first, Tesla wasn't that much of a threat because it started really high with electric vehicles, with like $100,000 electric vehicles, and then it introduced the Model S, which was $70,000. But then it introduced its most recent model, the Model 3, which is supposed to cost between $35,000 and about $45,000. Well, that's what a General Motors car costs. And they have had a lot of startup problems with the Model 3. They're not there yet. They don't have the production levels, but they've definitely demonstrated that you can come in and specialize in electric vehicles and take away some pretty high-powered buyers. So the Detroit companies are kind of late to this game, and I'm not 100% sure how large the electric vehicle market is going to be. I mean, it may be more of a specialty market. I think the bigger issue is alternatives to cars altogether, to owning cars, I should say, because since the car companies were bailed out in 2008, we've seen Uber and Lyft come along. We've seen a lot of places get bike sharing. We've seen scooters start to show up in cities all across the country. And a lot of people are rethinking whether they need to actually own a car at all. It doesn't mean that they won't use them. It just means that they won't actually pay for one and pay the insurance and the other costs that are related to that. Obviously, if you have a farm, you know, in Eau Claire, you're going to need a pickup truck. So I'm not saying that you're going to be riding a scooter. But if, you know, you're going to Marquette, you might get on a scooter once in a while.
There was question as to whether that was a temporary story. You had young people coming out of college, say, with debt in the Great Recession. Okay, sure, they're not going to buy a car now. No problem. Automakers might think things will recover. They'll have money. They'll start buying our cars in the future. Not necessarily so?
No, because the millennials. So millennials are people born between 1982 and the year 2000. The millennials love cities. So if you go to Chicago, millennials are everywhere, and they're staying longer in cities than boomers did and Gen Xers did. You know, the Gen Xers, you know, my generation, you might have lived in a city, but you got married and you had your kids, and then you went to the suburbs. The millennials are not necessarily, they're not getting married as young as some people used to. They're staying in cities longer after they get married or meet their partners. And then when they have their kids, they're kind of toughing it out and they're trying life in the city with children, you know. So their dream is not to have that big suburban home, you know, with a lawn and a pool. Their dream is to have some cool kind of a loft where they can walk to things. So it really is an attitudinal shift among these young people. And then their younger brothers and sisters are growing up watching them, you know, deal with life by not owning a car, and that's the message that they're getting. So I think it's not so much regular people, you know, people who are maybe 40 and up. I think it's people 40 and under that are pushing this big change on the car manufacturers.
Let's throw another factor in here now, tariffs. Tariffs on things like steel and aluminum, which I think are big parts of making cars still these days. Is this something, is this a big enough deal that it's closing plants or just a smaller fraction of the story?
No, what it's doing is it's taking away profits. So I've covered the car companies for a long time, and there used to be these annual negotiations with U.S. Steel and the other steelmakers over these contracts, and they would get down to the penny per ton of steel. I mean, like a $5 increase in a ton of steel would shake Detroit. You know, we can't afford that. And so to see these tariffs come in out of nowhere and to realize that, you know, they're going to have to swallow this, all the car companies are cost-cutting. It isn't just General Motors. I mean, Ford is looking for ways to cut costs, and so is Chrysler, and so are the Japanese and the German and the Korean car makers. So the steel tariffs have really shaken the industry, and they're trying to figure out, is there some way around them?
We're talking to Mickey Maynard, auto industry reporter, about thousands of layoffs at GM and the company's decision to close 5 plants in the U.S. and Canada.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about these closures and layoffs and what they mean for American workers? If you used to work in GM's Janesville plant, what memories does this news bring up for you? How did those layoffs affect you and your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Right now, we're picking up our conversation about layoffs and plant closures at General Motors. Mickey Maynard is with us. She's a longtime auto industry reporter.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a GM customer yourself with one of the brands they make? Are you sad to see some of these models go? If you are a person or household with no car, why did you opt to go without one? By necessity or by choice? Do you foresee yourself ever getting a car? Maybe if you have a family later in life. Do you have a question about these closures and how they all fit into the industry, what it means for workers, consumers, and car makers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Mickey, another piece of many moving pieces here. NAFTA, the trade deal formerly known as NAFTA, some updates, not a huge overhaul. Did any of the changes that just got made between Mexico, the U.S., and Canada factor into this GM decision?
I don't think the NAFTA 2, the revised NAFTA agreement, plays as much of a role in it. In fact, if you look at the language in NAFTA 2, essentially, there was some language that was meant to protect the Detroit car makers. There was going to be a limit put on the number of vehicles that could be built in Canada and then sent to the United States. And it was a pretty high ceiling, and there wasn't any opportunity really for Detroit to meet it. But now that General Motors is closing Oshawa, it definitely won't meet it. So I think one of the factors is the Canadian elections. So Justin Trudeau has to announce elections no later than next October of 2019, and the General Motors plant in Oshawa would be closing right around the end of the model year in 2019. So I think actually General Motors wanted to get the announcement out there before it became a Canadian election issue, but it probably will be a Canadian election issue anyway.
Speaking of the politics of this, we heard earlier President Trump angry about this deal, Ohio's Republican and Democratic U.S. senators angry about this deal, trying to put pressure from GM. Does it matter? Does anything they say really make a difference?
Well, it's interesting because Senator Sherrod Brown, who's one of the senators from Ohio, had introduced this legislation to give buyers of American cars, I think, a $3,500 tax credit. But, you know, that brings up the issue, what is an American car? Because really, there are more cars built at Toyota and Honda and Hyundai and Mercedes-Benz than there are built by the Detroit car makers right now because of the shift to SUVs and pickups. So you can give everybody a $3,500 credit to buy a car, but what we found out a few years ago when the government did something like this is that people just went and bought what they wanted to buy, and imports got their share of the business too. So legally, I'm not sure what can be done to fuel sales of American car company vehicles over Japanese, German, and Korean vehicles that are made in the United States.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is with us in Viroqua. Jeremy, hi. Well, we lost Jeremy. We will bring on Mark in Three Lakes then. Nope, something's wrong with our phones. Okay, let me try to sum up their questions. Jeremy, I think, was wondering about, do you know, this, Mickey, if these tariffs would affect other big manufacturers of things like tractors, your John Deere's and things like that? The auto industry, not the only one hit by steel or aluminum tariffs.
Oh, right. I mean, it affects everybody who uses steel and aluminum. And so if you're John Deere, if you're Harvester, if you're making lawnmowers, it affects anyone who uses those metals.
All right. Thanks for the call. I think we have a problem with our call screen right now, so we'll see if we can get any callers. Just you and me then in the meantime, mm-hmm. Mickey. So are you looking, all right, this is GM. Are you looking at Ford or Chrysler? Are there other shoes waiting to drop here?
Right. So everyone in Detroit is looking at Ford because if you'll remember, Ford did not get the federal bailout. Ford did not file for bankruptcy. But one of the things that has hit Ford is, you know, it self-financed. It went out and borrowed the money so it could do its overhaul 10 years ago. Now it's got to pay the debt. Now it's got to pay the interest on all of those loans. And Ford had talked about becoming this mobility company where it shifted away from automobile production and over to electric vehicles, but also partnerships with scooter companies and stuff like that. And what it found was that in the near term, there just isn't the money in that. And so they actually let their CEO go, who came up with this idea, and they've put back a strategy of, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to focus on this, but in the meantime, you know, we need to make sure that we make enough money to run the company. So everyone is watching Ford to see whether there will be job cuts. I don't expect plant closings at Ford only because I think Ford's closed just about everything that, you know, that they can close. But on the other hand, we didn't know that these General Motors plant closings were coming either. And then with Chrysler, there's so many questions about the future of Chrysler because the CEO of Fiat Chrysler died earlier this year. And you know, there's a new CEO, but nobody knows if he's going to follow the same strategy of the old one.
Talking to Mickey Maynard, auto industry reporter, looking at the GM announcement of plant closures. That announcement came earlier this week. Mickey, another change in the auto landscape. We had these CAFE standards, the fuel economy standards under the Obama administration going up over a course of years. Now the Trump administration backing away from those. How does that affect the auto industry?
Well, it's a time of some confusion over CAFE, and it's important because car makers do their product planning out about 5 years. And so, for example, I'm just pulling this number out of the air. if you know that in 2024 your vehicles have to achieve 35 mile per gallon fuel economy standards, you have to get the engines, you have to get the transmissions, you have to do the design work so that you can achieve that. And then if you're like in 2019 and you don't know, you know, you have to make a call of your own on whether those standards are going to be in place. And I think the other issue on fuel economy is that, you know, gasoline has been relatively inexpensive this year, and it's been coming down a lot lately. And so that tends to power sales of SUVs and pickup trucks. But there can always be some kind of global tension. There can always be something that sends gas prices and oil prices right back up again. And I think the auto industry has learned that that can change within months. So they really, I mean, people are kind of questioning the General Motors decision to kill all those cars, because what happens if oil prices go up and they don't really have a car lineup? So that's, you know, that raised eyebrows when they decided to kill the cars that they did.
I've seen some analysis about investing in the auto industry, and there's an idea that in the investment world, you've got people looking at Silicon Valley, ooh, sexy, dynamic, cool stuff coming out, Tesla, wow. And then they look at the big three in particular, ooh, boring, long-term thinking, stodgy, old-fashioned companies. Is that something that actually affects the financing of auto companies and the way they think?
Yes. I do think that investors got really carried away about Tesla. And I think, obviously, Tesla was a tech play versus a car play. And that was all fine until Tesla actually had to build some cars. And then their CEO made some very controversial statements, and all of a sudden, Tesla's stock loses some of its value. I think with the Detroit companies, it's been known for years now, ever since the companies came out of bankruptcy and ever since Ford dealt with its financial problems, that these are long-term investments that you usually buy for the dividends, not because you expect the stock price to go up. And there's a lot of people that look at that and go, well, gosh, I can buy a tech stock and I might gain $10, $20, $30 in a year, and it might be a faster way to make more money. You know, the days of buying a stock and keeping it 30 years are kind of over for a lot of investors, and that's still what you really have to do with the Detroit auto stock.
Now, we've seen ups and downs among the big three over decades, of course. Big picture, what is their health like in 2018?
Well, right at the moment, the car companies have been doing quite well. I mean, this year had been a good year for them. Now, with General Motors announcing the plant closings, it's a question of whether they'll take a charge against earnings in 2018 or wait until 2019. But until recently, this had been looked at as a good year for the car companies. Maybe not the best year ever, but certainly they've been profitable. So, and that is one of the things about Detroit, is that, you know, there is a school of thought that you make your cuts when you're making money because you don't want to be forced into making them when you're not making money.
We'll leave it there for now. Mickey, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Micheline Maynard. She's an author and journalist. She's been covering the auto industry for quite some years. She was with us to talk about the impact of GM's announced plant closures and layoffs and what it all says about the changes in the auto industry. Our phone lines died there, so we weren't able to hear from you. That said, you can still share your thoughts with us. You can message us on the Ideas Network Facebook page, email ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at Central Time WPR with your reactions to this news from GM. And if you've experienced a plant closure like these places in Ohio, Michigan, Ontario are going through now, you can tell us how it affected you, how it affected your neighborhood and your community. Again, you can always reach us. Email ideas@WPR.org, post or message on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. When you get tired during the day, do you reach for the coffee or try and take a nap? According to some what turns out to be older research that's suddenly all over the place on the internet, your best bet might be to do both. And Judith, you say you're a fan of the coffee nap.
Well, the funny thing
is, I didn't know it had a name.
It's a coffee nap.
Until you told me about it today. So it is very, very frequent on the weekends that I'll have my coffee in the morning. I often forget half a cup and it's kind of sitting around. We go out to lunch, come back home. I find my coffee. I finish what's there and I immediately take my post-lunch nap. So I've been doing it for years without knowing it was a thing.
And how do you feel after that coffee nap?
I feel great. I love naps. I am a champion napper. And yeah, I've been known to take the post-lunch nap, but there was actually a pre-lunch nap.
Wow, so, kind of a hobbit nap schedule.
Exactly.
I am nap deficient. I'm nap impaired. I can't, unless I'm sick, I am usually incapable of falling asleep. And if I do nap, I'm wrecked. I'm done for the day.
But you're not doing the coffee nap.
Not intentionally, no. I haven't given it a try.
Well, I have to admit, they said that the perfect amount of time is 30 minutes, and I tend to nap a little longer than that. But yeah, I've been a coffee nap believer without even knowing it was a thing.
So we're going to budget. Can we budget for an espresso machine and a hammock?
Sure. I have a hammock at home, actually. Maybe we can bring it in.
All right, donate it. Coffee naps coming up on Central Time.